You are listening to the For the Rose Tech Podcast, episode 295. Big news from Maker Faire, Google I.O., and TechCrunch Disrupt. Season 7, episode 295 of the Furlow Bros Tech Podcast. Today is May the 21st, 2017. I'm Matthew Dean Furlow, and discovering aliens on an alien world is my brother James Furlow.
Oh yeah, Alien Covenant came out this weekend, didn't it? Amazing! Did you see it? Did you love it? Would you scare your pants off?
I didn't see it.
I'm not a big alien fan. I'm honest. I'm not a big scary movie fan in general.
I will say this. The original Alien and Aliens are definitely worth watching, just as...
That's what I hear.
As
cultural.
Yeah. Just as it's a cultural thing.
It's in my wish list on iTunes, I guess. Yeah. If it was on Netflix, I'd probably do it.
Yeah. Yeah, just as cultural things. It's sort of like you should see Terminator 1 and 2. You should see...
But those aren't scary. Those are just awesome. There's a difference.
Yes. I don't know. The first Terminator... The first Terminator was a bit on the... It's kind of a sci-fi horror.
It's graphic.
It's similar. Honestly, Alien and Terminator are very similar in that it's unstoppable.
It's not that scary.
Yeah, it's an unstoppable monster force that pops out of places in the least expense. Yes. It's very tense. The tenseness is off the charts.
Gotcha.
And yeah,
Sigourney Weaver, right?
Yes,
that was like her breakout role.
Yep,
from what I understand.
And in Aliens, they make a reference to Terminator, and they talk about the Cyberdyne system. Like robots and stuff. It's pretty funny.
I have to watch it.
I know.
All right. I'm convinced.
But yeah, they're pretty good.
So, where are you broadcasting from today?
Does it not look like it normally does for me? Can you not tell?
Is that still the old place?
It's still the old place.
I thought you said you had new internet. I thought that's when you officially moved.
No, I don't have new internet there yet. I've signed up for internet, but it turns out that AT&T's gigabit Ethernet they can't just mail you the stuff, the hardware to plug in. They got to do like hardware upgrades or something. So they're going to show up and have to do stuff on Saturday, next Saturday. So next week I'll be broadcasting with over 1,000 megabits per second.
All right, so if something freezes, it's your fault for one more week.
Okay. I don't think that's true, but...
Yeah, I know.
But yeah,
I'm pumped about my new modem, to be honest, but okay, all right. Well, it looks cleaner. Maybe that's the difference.
Well, it's definitely missing all the...
It's missing a couch.
Yeah, that's the big thing. And it's missing it's missing some posters and stuff. My room is starting to look bleak.
Yeah.
And,
that's a way to say it.
Yeah.
But yeah. In a good way, you know. That's
yeah,
cool.
Exactly.
That's cool. So I noticed you got a fan in the background. Does your new place have AC? Or
Heck yeah.
Is it full of heaters in the house?
Right?
Fans are heaters.
It's true. They add energy to the system. No, we have AC, which is pretty cool.
Dang.
My office, which also happens to be our one-car garage, does not.
So have you landed on which room is yours yet?
Yes. So there's three rooms in this new place. There's a big, big room that's like twice as big as the other rooms.
Yeah. With a bathroom. To it, right?
Yeah, it's really
the
nice.
The master ensuite.
Yeah, and then we have a medium room, which is slightly bigger than the small room, and an attached one car garage. And how we decided was the big room, that person pays the most. The two small rooms, they split the rest, but the smallest room also gets the one-car garage.
And being that you said the one-car garage is your office, I'm guessing that means this is deductive reasoning.
Yes.
You got the small room.
Yes.
Well played, sir. I think you won in this deal.
You know what? Honestly...
In this Faustian bargain.
Right? I think...
Is that the right phrase?
I don't know. Faustian?
Yeah.
I don't know.
It's where you get what you want, but... you didn't really get what you wanted.
Mm.
You know, like with genies where you make a wish and they grant your wish, but is that really? I'm going to look it up. F-A-U Faustian bargain. Man, Google's so smart. I just did F-A-U and it just knew. In a legend, traded his soul to the devil in exchange for knowledge. To strike a Faustian bargain is to be willing to sacrifice anything to satisfy a limitless desire for knowledge or power. Oh, never mind. What am I talking about?
Yeah, that was definitely not what I did.
Wow. It was this idea of just like, it seems like a good trade, but it's not. That's where I was headed.
Gotcha. Yeah, for them. For me, hopefully it's not the case. But
it's the middle guy who kind of got the shaft.
Yeah, but he's happy. I mean, like, that was what... He was upset with the idea of paying.
So did let's see, did TM go for the big room?
Yeah, I did.
Yeah, I had no doubt about that situation.
Yeah, which I'm okay with, because the big thing is that he and I have the same schedule, and the third guy doesn't. So we needed, and we got two bathrooms. So it's like the two guys with the same schedules, one should be in the big room with their private bathroom, one should be in one of the smaller rooms with the shared bathroom. So now there's never, nobody has to wake up early to get in the shower, which is nice. But yeah, it all worked out fine.
Awesome, man.
I'm very excited.
It's exciting. Congratulations.
I'm moving. I had to move the couch all by myself today, but it's all right.
How'd that work out? Pretty good?
Pretty good. I'm really strong, so.
Right.
Diana texted me this today. I was like, oh, I had to move the couch all by myself. She was like, oh my gosh, I didn't realize you had to do it all alone. And I responded back saying, with guns like mine, I'm never alone.
I was expecting a response like, oh, I wasn't alone. I had two guns with me.
Exactly. Anyways, you know what, James? We're not here to talk about my guns this week.
I wish we were.
I know, right? This week, like every week, we'll be talking about technology and the continuing corporate opera. And by that, we mean the soap opera of corporations, dealings back and forth, the people working for them, their marketing campaigns, and of course, the technology they're developing. But before we get into the heart of the show, James got a short disclosure he wants to throw our way.
Yes, I founded and work for HPI, but I do not represent HPI or any of their opinions. I also own part of Biz Stone, who now is working for Twitter, and Etsy and Lending Club.
Nice. Nice. Biz Stone. You own... Oh, yeah, I guess you would own. I get it.
I'm a stockholder.
I was going
to
say...
Twitter. He's coming back to work for Twitter, so therefore, ergo, ips facto, I own Biz Stone.
Yeah, Biz Stone doing his Biz Stone thing where he gets busy with busy
proud.
Stones. He's nobody really is sure what he does, but
he's
it's
in charge of culture
valuable,
and people,
which
is important.
Again, nobody's really sure what he does. you did not contradict what I said.
I would not mind having that role. I just want to make sure. It's like fancy HR. Is that?
yeah. Yeah. He's cool.
Is he? I don't know. Never met him.
Well, me neither.
I know. I'm harassing you.
Yeah. So what do we do now? I can't remember.
Find us online.
If you want to follow us throughout the week. Oh my gosh. I can't believe I'm about to have this do this. If you want to follow us throughout the week, you can do that by going to Twitter at Matthew D. Furlow. You go to my Instagram at NextWigan4. I'm not sure why you would, because I completely fail at posting things. We'll get into it in a second. I went to Maker Faire this weekend. Ooh. And didn't post a single thing.
And you didn't post a single thing? You're
thing.
A horrible
I know.
Individual.
I know.
You are a horrible person.
I'm like, I got an excuse.
No, you don't.
You're right.
Did your phone break? Did you forget it?
No.
Okay. No excuse.
You're right. I've got no excuse. Excuses are like, I'm not going to go there.
Let's see. I'm also on Twitter, which I retweet most of the time, I'll be honest. And I was actually thinking about this today while I was resyncing photos to my Google Photo thing, going, man, I don't take enough pictures anymore. I need to get back to that. So I'm with you too. So in case you're interested, I'm on Instagram. Does Google have a, I don't know, they got an app that... social thing? Nope. They're out of that. It's all about AI.
AI.
Furlong, everywhere.
What does the A stand for? We should like link to that video so people understand why I say that every time we talk about AI. it's not even that funny in context, but out of context, it's completely meaningless. furloughbros.com is where you can go to see everything, like where we'll inevitably link to the Red vs. Blue episode where that quote is from, but also all the articles, videos, anything else we talk about this evening that will be posted online at furloughbros.com. You can go check it out. Get a very in-depth sense of what happened this week. I'll give you a hint. Google I.O.
What do you mean TechCrunch Disrupt New York?
Yeah, right. Did they do that this week?
They did, apparently.
That's really funny.
One representative story.
And
because there was a theme, but...
You know what? You're right. They did do it this week because I went through TechCrunch last this week. And when I busy weeks, I tend to like power through the feeds at the very end of the week. And TechCrunch, because they like, because you can't just click on an article and read their article on their news feed, you have to click through to the article. A lot of times I'll go through them last and I'll scan it. And I'll only look at articles that get like 500 views and more. And I saw one article about TechCrunch on their feed. Yeah, they got swamped by themselves this week. That's rough. But it's not what we're here to talk about, James. Let's talk about Maker Faire.
Or then potentially it's jumped the shark. But anyways.
Yeah, well. You know what hasn't jumped the shark, James?
What? Maker Faire?
Maker Faire.
Let's talk about it. So you went.
I went. Was there. I was present.
Is it spelled with an E? Is that legit?
Yeah.
F-A-I-R-E?
Yes.
Is it always spelled that way?
Yes. It's weird. Oh. I don't actually know why. But if you click on the link, that's how they spell it.
That's how they spell it.
All right. So the Maker Faire. I went. I presented. So this is kind of fun.
You presented?
No, I didn't present.
Oh.
Sorry.
I'm all excited there.
I presented myself.
You were present.
That's what I meant.
Got it.
It's more accurate than what I said. So we went, and what was kind of cool was I took my girlfriend, and she had never...
That is cool.
She'd never gone before. She was kind of unaware of the particulars of it. I didn't, like... I don't want to say purposefully, but I tried not to, like, really oversell it or anything, because it is... It's overwhelming, and it's hard to really get your head around what it is until you go and see it.
Are they related at all to Make Magazine?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it's like the same thing. Same organization. Right.
Cool.
Yeah, that's why they get like the MakeBot.
I got that magazine for like whatever a subscription cycle is, a year.
Mm-hmm.
And it just made me feel dumb every time I got it. And so I eventually stopped because I didn't like feeling dumb.
You know, I'll be honest. That's how I feel about most of their publications.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And I don't know why, but they're for a community that's supposedly all about like being really accessible, reaching kids and helping people make the things that they want to make. I find that their publications are incredibly inaccessible. And they can be dense and confusing to somebody like me who's like really into it. And, you know, like, whereas like Hackaday, Life Hacker, things like those, they're really great. Instructables. I think Instructables should be what, Make Magazine should be. And they're not, they're like miles apart because Instructables, you'll see the most.
Yeah. I'm with you there.
Yeah. You'll see the most incredible stuff and they'll just like break it down piece by piece by piece and be like, yeah, this is how you make this really incredible project. And sometimes they'll be like, this is how you make this really dumb project, but I'm really thorough about it. And there's, I don't know. Anyways, the fair is completely different because it's just an enormous amount of people showing what they've made. And there's all sorts of different levels. And I've tried to figure out how to describe it to people in a way that was accurate. But it's hard to do. The best I could come up with, I was like, it's like a really high-powered, like, arts and crafts fair, but with a lot more technology involved. And And a lot more impressive art. Like there's real, there's not just, yeah, it's really interesting. There's people selling stuff. There's people displaying, showing stuff. There's people recruiting. I got an Arduino t-shirt while I was there. As you can see, I'm wearing my,
oh, look at that.
Yeah.
So it's a, what's it? It looks like, an infinity sign with a plus and minus.
Yeah.
And this is Arduino underneath it.
Yeah.
Is that an infinity sign or does that represent something else?
That's, I think it's infinity. It's just the Arduino, it's their logo. Any,
is that, there's something, what is that, upper left-hand corner?
Dude, it's just a R TM for, yeah, R? It's a, I mean, if you look at the, I'm gonna see if you can, is it?
Okay, I see some sort of board thingy with a chip on it.
Let me expand my screen so I can actually see it. So this is an Arduino Mega. You can, it's having a hard time zooming in, but you can kind of see the infinity symbol. With the plus and the minus,
oh, yeah.
On the board, yes. That's just their logo. But anyways,
it's just their logo.
But man, this place is awesome. There's so many cool things, and it's like we it's kind of fun because I knew that there was this one tent that my, they're not really tents, they're buildings, they're enormous, but they call them tents. One of the tents was this like food and gardening and ecology tent for makers. And so, like, they had, like, picklers and kombucha and tea and all that sort of, like, and hydroponic setups. And I knew that that was something that my girlfriend would be really into. So I was, like, really excited. Like, I didn't tell her about it until we got there. And so we're just starting to see what it's like. And she's starting to, like, wrap her head around, okay, I kind of get what this is. And that's what I told her. I was like, oh, and by the way, we're going to go across this place and we're going to go to like the food tent. And she was like, what?
That's cool.
Yeah, it was really neat. But yeah, we shot, oh my gosh, we saw so much stuff, James. It was nuts. I saw I saw some dudes that were doing, what's it called? CNC mills and CNC routers. And I really want to get into that. Yeah, just talking to them, and I'm like, it's going to be expensive. But now that I have a garage to keep it in,
it's less expensive now.
Exactly. It's downright affordable, James. I've done the hard thing. I saw
you'd almost be foolish not to.
I know. Pretty much. You know what? I met a dude who bought one, started his own company, and he's like, it paid for itself in like 6 months. I know that seems like a good. So there's a company that I got to introduce you to called Maker Muscle, and they make customizable actuators.
Really?
Yes.
Interesting.
They have a Kickstarter.
It piqued my interest.
I know,
because you can open a window with an actuator.
Yes, you can quite easily. So I took their card.
Appreciate that.
Yeah, it was pretty cool.
Appreciate you making the connection.
Yeah, it was. You're welcome. Yeah, I don't know. There's just such cool stuff. There were guys that were doing like resin.io, which I've actually heard about before, but I got to meet them. And they do GitHub Docker pushes to Internet of Thing devices. So if you're selling your Internet of Thing devices, and let's say they're all running Raspberry Pis, you like want to do a software update to them all, it can be really difficult to do. Because like you have to build entire operating systems around doing that. Which like if you're Apple and you have to build these infrastructures and it can be very difficult. And these guys are like, if you're just on a Raspberry Pi, the best. Yeah.
I'm making sure I understand this. So it's not necessarily for a DIYer. It's for, I've created a company that, say, opens Windows.
Yeah.
And I want to push and I've been selling it to hundreds of thousands of people, and I want to do a software update because WWDC happened, or Google and Panther APIs, blah, blah, blah. And they would help me push the software update out to my hundreds of thousands of
customers. Well, what's really great is that it's that if you've got 100,000 customers, you have software developers that build that infrastructure for you.
Okay.
If you have 20 customers, ooh, that's where they're clutch. Because your only option at that when you're like a small startup, just really getting going with this hardware, is to SSH into somebody else's device, which has huge security ramifications, and it's quite difficult to do and safely. And so they allow you to, in a very secure way, push updates out, which is pretty cool.
Interesting.
I saw a guy that was selling, it's called Drive. He sells this little CPU driver that it's not a CPU. It's a printed circuit board. It's a PCB. It's got a couple chips on it. But instead of using stepper motors for doing stuff like driving your 3D printer or your CNC router, it allows you to use brushless DC motors, which is really awesome because they're cheaper and quieter. And they can be as powerful. It's just that the controlling circuits can be a little more complicated. There's not as much support for it. And so you're just starting to see that take off. We saw a company called Poquito. They've got a Kickstarter where they're doing these Poquito. It's like a customizable little game thing, but it's basically an Arduino style microcontroller with digital I/O and a little screen that you can connect to, but it's designed for people to hack and to make video games and stuff. And they seemed really cool. There's all sorts of, what was the other one? I went and talked to some watchmakers. I told them about my clock idea, and they were like, that sounds really cool. And they were coming up with suggestions, and I was telling them why that was difficult or impossible. And they were coming back to me like, yeah, that sounds really hard. I was like, I know, right? This is frustrating. But the coolest ones that I think you'll appreciate was I was walking along, and we came up to this guy who had a display where he had all these interlockable blocks, and they looked like they were just made out of like medium density fiber boards. And basically what he was trying to do is educate people how to make these things really easily, how you set up your tools, your jigs and stuff, so that you can make these toy interconnecting blocks very cheaply, very effectively. And it was a really interesting like display in that he wasn't trying to sell anything. He was just trying to help educate people how to build this like children's toy. And Diana pointed at the screen the little display that he had going on, because each display has the Maker Faire makes a little like sign for them that is the name of the company, description of what the company does, and a little blurb about the company and the person at the company. And the guy, as I'm reading it, it says Bill Atkinson.
Really?
Yeah.
Huh.
Does the name sort of ring a bell for you?
Yeah, Photocards, Apple.
Yeah.
Something with them.
Yeah. Same Bill Atkinson. And
just won't die.
I know. He's only like 65. That's the funniest part. I told our parents about it, and they're like, how old is he now? I was like, he's really not that old.
Turns out all of the people who are early in tech are still pretty young.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and it happened that he was really young when he joined Apple. So like, yeah, like you said, he wrote QuickDraw. He wrote Mac Paint. He built the HyperCard software. Like, he's a pretty big deal in the history of Macintosh. And importantly, it's the first program that I ever used on a computer. So that was like, wow, this guy's a big deal in my history. And Diana was like, you should go and talk to him.
So did you?
I worked up a little bit of courage and I walked over and like, so you're Bill Atkinson? And he goes, yeah. And I was like, you wrote QuickDraw? And he was like, yeah. And so we started chatting for a little bit. And I was like, so like, how at 27 did you get in at Apple? And he goes, well, at the time he was getting his PhD in Washington State.
There's your first clue.
Yeah, exactly. But he was, and I can't remember the guy's name, but it was another Apple guy where they were like, where when he said the name and I immediately recognized it. And unfortunately, I can't remember it now, but I was like, okay, he was one of your big people at Apple at the time. But he was like, hey, Bill, you should come down. We're working on some really cool stuff at Apple. And Bill was like, nah, I got to finish my PhD. I want to do research. Like I got another 6 months to finish. So I'm not into it. And the guy was like, I'll tell you what, I'll buy you a round trip ticket. You come down Friday night, you spend the weekend down here, and you can be back to work by Monday and just come and check it out. So Bill was like, okay, fine, I'll go down. Flew down, and of course he meets Steve. And I had to clarify, which Steve?
And he goes, Wozniak, of course.
No, he goes, Jobs.
I know.
And so we were walking around. And Ballmer and
and I knew I hated that guy and I would work against him the rest of my life.
Yeah, exactly. So Jobs takes him around the office and he meets everybody and he's having conversations and whatnot.
He's a salesman.
Yeah. What I love about that is that Bill came down on the weekend and so Steve brought him around the office on the weekend and met everybody on the weekend. Which is one of those details that like it didn't emphasize, but was definitely like, yeah, that was okay. And so met everybody, really liked everybody. And I guess Steve was like, so you know how like you really like high tech stuff, you like working on things. And Bill was like, yeah, definitely. He was like, well, just remember that like there's a 2-year delay between when we invent something and it hits the consumer market. Like we're always 2 years ahead of the market. And if you really want to change the world, you need to be using those tools early on, you know, when they're invented. You can't be using them 2 years later. I mean, here's the question. When you're surfing, do you like to be on the breaking wave or do you like to be doggy paddling behind it?
Doggy paddle, man.
And Bill was like, 2 weeks later, I was working for Apple.
Yeah, that sounds about right. That's like, amazing.
Yeah, he's like, never finished my PhD. I was like, yeah, wow. I don't.
Not when you get that kind of sales pitch.
I know. Gosh, that's such a job sales pitch, dude. When you're surfing.
That's amazing.
Do you like being on the breaking wave or you like ducky bailing behind it? Oh, you do make it. Jobs had such a good way of – every time you hear somebody talk about when Jobs made their pitch, especially early on, like made his pitch of you should work for Apple, they're always such amazing ones. I mean, when you spend your life being a sugar water salesman, like,
yeah,
that's devastating. I don't know. It's good stuff. But that was cool. And
that's awesome, yeah. Man.
And you know what my favorite part about the Make a Fair was, and is like, what's his name? The guy from MythBusters, not the one with the walrus mustache.
Jamie,
the other one. No,
that's the other one.
What's his name? You gotta help me out.
Adam.
Yeah.
Savage.
Yeah, Adam Savage. Adam Savage showed up on Sunday, and. And tested guys do a bunch of stuff, which is Savage's project now. But they like, but you get these like pretty big celebrities show up for lack of a better word in the maker community, and it's cool. Then they're there and like and they draw a big crowd. But to me, it's the fact that Bill Atkins is just there, like. Trying to, his display was literally called "Make Your Own Interlocking Blocks." Like, what? and he's just, hey, I'll talk to you about Apple. It's cool. And there's like, there's so many people there like that. Actually, one of the funniest ones was we walk up and there was these guys that had the display about stop motion. They were doing these stop motion videos and they had their puppets there and it was really cool, really neat. So Diane and I were like watching it. And as we're talking, one of the guys next to us goes like, yeah, so we like hear him start talking about aliens and how there are aliens here and we have to get them out of our world. And like he's clearly talking about extraterrestrial aliens to this other person. And Diane and I are kind of like, what is going on with this guy? And we're like looking at each other, kind of questioning it. And the guy that we're talking to about like their stop motion puppets, all of a sudden he realizes we're kind of hearing this in the conversation. He goes, oh yeah, do you want to know about the aliens that are amongst us? And like hands us this 8.5 by 11 sheet of paper that has like 16 facts about the aliens that are amongst us. And that's when I like look at their shirts and it's like, it says, get off our turf. And it's got a big old alien, like face with a big red circle and a cross through it. And they're amongst us. And like all of a sudden we realize that like, make your fair vets people before they let you in. And so that there's, so that you've got to be part of the maker community. You have to be a maker. And so they came with like their Trojan horse of we do stop motion puppets, but they were there entirely to advocate for the fact that aliens are here. They're amongst us and we need to get rid of them.
I'm
like,
with them.
I was like, and it was seriously one of those things where like the contrarian me wanted to engage with these guys, but like they were really serious and I could just see like getting roped into like an hour long conversation with them when we're trying to see everything. Like there's a lot to see. And so we kind of, Diane and I kind of walked away slowly.
But back this up.
Oh my gosh. It was kind of a highlight.
Wow. Sounds like it.
Yeah. It was great. It was cool. It's I definitely recommend it. If you're ever in the Bay Area this time of year, or New York, whenever they do it over there, I don't know why you'd want to do it over there. New York is dumb. This is the best coast, West Coast. But but yeah, check it out. It's definitely worth the time. It's very cool. It's inspiring.
Yeah, sounds like it. Dude, that's awesome. That's very cool. Well, that wasn't the only conference to happen this week.
Sorry,
TechCrunch had one as well, as we alluded to. Disrupt New York. It was this week, 15 through 17. There are a lot of different startups, but there's one that I think is a good representation of an entire slew of them. And this one is called Houseio. Care to guess what they are trying to disrupt?
Houses?
Houses! That's right. Yeah, which obviously catches my attention for a variety of reasons. But seriously, they were like one of like five or six different real estate-related startups that were making pitches up top. So definitely something that seems to be a trend right now that for whatever reason, startups seem to think there's an opportunity there.
Yeah.
For whatever reason.
We'll see. It's kind of hoping that nobody else would notice.
Yeah. But anyway, so I don't necessarily want to talk about them specifically other than they're essentially they're doing the whole software thing, right? Where they will help you do everything. So let's say you decide you want to sell your house. You sign up on their service. They help you determine what the value of it is. They give you advice on pictures to take. They obviously will help you list it. And then they will help you with the paperwork side of things and then even finding an escrow agent and the other side of it. So they're really going after that for sale by owner, which I actually think is poised to really take off, and agents are probably in trouble because I think it's going to be a lot of for sale by owner with help.
Yeah.
And they're definitely one of those people who are companies that are on the wave, not paddleboarding, to stick with some random guy's analogy. And I think that's why we saw so many of them at Disrupt this year, just because they all realized it. There was another interesting one. I didn't link to them. But the idea is you could sell fractional shares of equity in your house. So you know how like you have a house and sometimes you have equity.
I don't have a house. But yeah, I know what you're talking about.
People have in houses. Principle. And usually the way that you tap that equity in your house is you go to a bank and you fill out a long mortgage and notes and you say, please. And then a bank gives you a loan for it. While they are saying, dude, let's take this to the crowd. what if you've got supposedly, you know, $10,000 worth of equity in your house? And so instead of it being like one bank that gives you 10 grand, you find 10 people who give you $1,000 each. And through that, they earn interest back on your equity.
Nice.
So, yeah, which I actually thought was a super fascinating idea. Let's see. They and the way they make their money, it's all flat fees. And then there's is a percentage paid for like ads and stuff, of course. But yeah, it just seems to be a... again, it's just it's software. H-O-U-Z-E-O. Howzeo is the website. That just seems poised to for or yeah, seems like an industry that is poised for disruption.
Nice.
For certain, especially if you want to sell on your own. Which I've told my agent, I'm like, I hate to be this way, buddy, but I'm probably never gonna sell through you. So that's all right. I'm like, I wouldn't feel good about myself for not taking advantage of some of these cool tools so I can learn about them. And I'm starting to head down the track of like, I'm probably not going to buy much through him either at this rate. So easy to do on your own.
Yeah.
Which is crazy. But yeah, so Disrupt, I thought that was just an interesting theme that is happening.
Yeah, that is really fascinating. That, yeah, like you said, it's definitely something that seems poised for disruption.
Well, you see, like, there's different... there are different bigger trends, and it feels like, which is half the joke about TechCrunch or Disrupt, kind of like, oh, jump the shark. It's like mobile feels like it's happened.
Yeah.
You know, that's been conquered, done to death. Sweet. There's going to be some refinements. There's always going to be another cool app where you're like, oh, that's interesting. But I feel like that's it's done.
You know what it is?
Outside of an interface for something else.
It's table stakes.
Table stakes. There you go. And so people are, you know, once again, trying to say, what's the next industry?
Yeah.
And AI is one that everyone's like, that's a software that will allow
what
us to take off, take on other industries. I think, you know, we've talked about virtual reality and artificial reality. Nope. Augmented reality. And, you know, which again, I think are tools. And I think that the industries that people are recognizing, they're saying real estate, medical is definitely a big one. I think there's always this dream of finance that will never happen.
Yeah.
But, the dream can live. There's just too much. Yeah, we'll see. I don't know if we can get rules changed for driving vehicles. Maybe we can get rules changed for finance and medical stuff. Maybe.
Yeah. It's funny. I was thinking about the other day about I've wrapped onto something in my head that I'm like trying to figure out the best way to communicate a trend to people in my industry about the inevitability of what's going to happen to us, and the best way to sort of explain what will inevitably happen to us. And the best analogy
what are you talking about? What's inevitably going to happen to us?
Oh, that we're going to go away. That mechanical engineers won't be needed anymore. Which is a weird thing to say. To some degree, there will be. But specifically the type of mechanical engineering that I do, which is design/drafting. you have an idea. You need to build and you want to design it. You need to build it. You need to bring it into the real world. It needs to be mechanically sound. It has to have particular material characteristics. You have to understand. And there's a lot of training and intuition that goes into it to know that if you want strength here, you have options. You can change the material. You can change the design. You can thicken it. You can change the shape. Knowing what to do is where, like, that's why we're worth money, is because we know that, okay, you can actually make this part a lot lighter by making it a different material, much thinner, and adding one rib here, or you could make it this material and just make it a giant block. And the reason my boss doesn't listen to me when I say stuff like that is frustrating, but it's besides the point. One of the things that I talk about is like trying to describe why we're going to go away. And the industry that I've seen that I think best encapsulates the trend that's going to happen are travel agents, where for a long time it was this difficult task that took a lot of specialized training and intuition to understand how to create a travel for somebody. How do you find, you know, how do you book hotels? How do you find airports? And it had a lot to do with having special connections and the time to parse the information, to go through and understand it. And what ends up, and how it sort of begins, is it begins by building tools that sort of automate the thing that you're doing internally. You want to make the individual, you want to make the jobs of the individual travel agents more easy. So each of the airlines, since the airline wants the travel agent to go to you, you make your information more structured, easier to understand, easier to And what ends up happening is travel agents become more efficient, so they can handle more clients, which increases competition, which drives down the price of the travel agents. So travel agents can charge less and less and less for their service. It becomes more and more difficult to do it. You see consolidation into a smaller number of travel agents until you see the first rudimentary tools to help the consumer completely circumvent the travel agent, which was the first like searchable. You could go to a particular airline and you could search their on their website to look for flights without having to go through a travel agent. And now all of a sudden you're into this thing of, okay, now it's self-service. And what the tools did at that point were these tools that were meant to make things more convenient for the travel agents, made them more efficient, making them more competitive. And then eventually those tools became so easy that you could start turning those tools to face consumers directly. And then as those tools become more powerful, and more companies, bigger companies come in to bring all the airlines together into one giant bow tie, now all of a sudden it's like impossible to have a job as a travel agent, because it's too easy to do it on your own, just going through Expedia or whatever. And what you're watching is more and more consolidation and more competition until that job just doesn't really exist anymore, outside of being the personal assistant to somebody who literally doesn't have the time to say anything but set up a trip. These are my meeting schedules. Set up a trip that helps me make these. And then they're just personal assistants at this point.
I was talking with a friend this weekend about power washing. And I was like, hey, do you have a power washing dude? Like, can I have his contact information? He was like, no, I don't. But I'll tell you what. Let's you and I go in together. Let's buy a power washer that we can get a nice one, split the costs. And, you know, that would, you know, you'd probably spend the same amount as if you hired a power washer. And he's like, and then you'd have access to one. And I was like, no, you don't understand. Like, I don't want to do it. Like, cost is not the issue.
Yeah.
I do not want to spend a Saturday power washing my sidewalk. I would rather pay someone else to do that.
Right.
And, you know, and that's where that it comes in, where like some people enjoy the hunt. Yeah, the cheapest fare. So people are like, whatever.
Yeah, just cut. Yeah, give me all the details. Give me the best price. That's fine. I'll pay you a cut.
Make a recommendation and give me some options.
And that is more and more what the tools are becoming. That's what they're. It's all about consolidating it and turning these tools so that they're easiest for the consumer to use. And that's what's going to happen to mechanical engineering is. The tools that are being built for us make it easier and easier for us to do our job. It automates the process of making drafting documents. It automates the process of figuring out how to do reliability testing and overall design decisions. And eventually they're going to start making that step to being tools that do the mechanical engineering for you to such an extent where they're really not even designed for mechanical engineers anymore. They're now designed for the bosses of the mechanical engineers, the people that were hiring you to do a job. Well, I'm just going to buy this software to do it for me. And the reason why this is all important is because it seems like it's the sort of thing that is going to fit nicely into the real estate trend too. And the only thing that really slows that down is the licensing. It's the fact that it's the legality of it. It's the, there are more legal hoops to hop through. And mechanical engineering, it's really dangerous because because engineering is licensed state by state. So for civil engineers, they've got a little more protection in that you got to have that stamp before any of these drawings can be, you know, can be sold to consumers. But for mechanical engineering, since we sell across state lines, there's no licensing necessary. And so very few mechanical engineers are licensed, and unless you're doing power plant stuff, and then it's, you know, so I don't know. It's just, it's an interesting, yeah, it's an interesting paradigm to look through these,
trend. And I think like what I've heard with like the agent stuff is there obviously will still be some, but there'll be niche things like for, which I think is what you're saying for like your engineers, where it's like, you'll have an agent, they do the complicated deals, like the, like a travel agent, where I think like at one point in time, you know, before life happened to you, and like when you were going to go, you were talking about going to Rio for the Olympics, you were like, you know what? I want a travel agent to help me with this because there's enough moving parts here.
Right.
That I don't want to find out that I'm in a hotel that's 2 hours away. That's a garbage hotel. And I don't have the tickets to the events that I want, you know, and that's a niche request. And, you know, but if you're just like, oh, I'm just going to, you know, just on a regular vacation, cool, you know,
right.
Do whatever. And I know like when I went on my honeymoon, we had someone help us get our tickets and stuff. Cause I was like, I don't know, it's international and I'm young and dumb. And it was good, but, I don't know. I think today I'm like, oh, I could do it.
Yeah. Yeah.
just a few short, 10 short years later, here. 8 short years later.
Right. So by the way, have you ever seen the video of the, No Asians?
No.
It's a guy's trying to like rent out his place or lease out it or something. And, and he put this, newspaper ad into the news, and it's like, it gives the description of it. And the very last tagline says No Asians. And, it's an Australian dude, and the news media goes to question him on why he would do something so racist. And, it's fantastic.
I'll have to watch
it's really good.
Link to it underneath the Howzio article.
Yes. It's, his explanation is great.
Nice.
And if you're, yeah, just go check it out. Anyways, let's get to the main event, James. It's time.
Yeah, speaking of software eating the world.
Googly. Get all googly-eyed.
Man, Google I.O.
Yeah, man. This is big week.
So they had a little two-hour shindig.
Yeah, talked about the
future. And they referenced another one that I didn't watch because I wasn't into that one. The developer keynote thing. Yeah, their main one, and then the few times they referenced... And we'll talk more about to you on the developer keynote.
Yeah.
Like, all right.
Yeah. I'll read the synopsis.
Yeah, or not even that.
Yeah.
Yeah, so Google, they're back.
Yeah, man. Once a year.
I'll be honest. I'm gonna have steal your thunder, I think, here. I sometimes get the feeling that I backed the wrong horse.
Yeah, because I just so the audience knows what we're talking about. Let me see if I can look it up. It was 5/19, so 3 days ago, Thursday. I texted James and said, "I know the iPhone is a better phone. I know the iPhone 8 will be the best phone, but I hear the siren call of Android." I'm not necessarily.
This is where it gets difficult. I'm not necessarily Android. But there's a bunch of other Google services that, yes.
Yeah.
Assistant, pretty awesome. Photos, pretty awesome. Which, nice part about Google is they play nice, so you kind of get the best of both worlds if you stick with Apple.
No, and that's actually, you know, I think this is actually probably a good way to, good context to talk about this, because one of the interesting articles I read about was why Android's best features are in apps and not the OS. And it basically gets into the idea of how, like, Google makes its money on services. It doesn't make its money on hardware. And so it doesn't want its features to be tethered to a particular piece of hardware, whereas Apple does. So Google has a huge incentive to make all of their stuff, all of the features that normally Apple would announce on an OS level, they want to announce in apps. And they want those apps to be interportable. They want them to be as accessible on iOS as they are on Android, as they are on Chrome, as they are on anywhere, on the web, whatever. So there's a real impetus for them to, and you'll see that as a continuing theme, because it's like they announced what Google O is, or Android O is going to be all about, and I don't understand what their like announcement cycle for Android is, because it seems completely untethered from Google I/O, but yet they make a really big deal about it at Google I/O. Like, everything that they talked about, I felt like I already knew because I had read articles about, like, this is what they're going to do with Android O.
That's because they did a developer preview a few months back.
And then they talk about, this is what we're doing with Android O. Like, we already knew that. And they're like, and we're going to launch it later. And we'll tell you what the name is. And we'll tell you what it does again. You're like, we already know. Just launch it. Why are you talking about
it? Yeah, the conference is weird in that regards. And I actually had an article at the end, but why not? I'll hit it now. That was this idea of like Google's perfect future will always be just around the corner. Yeah. And it was by Wired. And it was very interesting where he was like, look, you listen to, and I feel myself doing this. He's like, you listen to I/O and like, there are super cool things that they're talking about, and we're going to go through some of them. But he's also like, left and right, like, the future, we will be doing this. That will be amazing. And you're like, yeah, I guess that sounds cool. Like, I don't know, what were some examples? We're getting into AR eventually. Yeah.
Well, the one that really got me was I was like, I read about it, and I was excited about it enough that I was looking for links to it, Googling it before I realized it didn't exist yet, but it's Google for Jobs, where they're like, basically, we're going to scrape everything to try to for data to figure out what jobs are available. And then we're going to take your resume and we're going to scrape a bunch of resumes and we're going to take all of that data automatically. And we're going to put it together to find you the perfect job on planet Earth. And you're like, wow, that sounds really cool. Like I kind of want to try that out just to see what you think I'd be good at. And yeah, it's definitely, we're going to be doing that eventually. Like, oh, great. Okay. I see. And there was another great example of this, that from last year that I didn't really realize. I was reading about how Daydream got announced last year, their VR platform. And I made a big deal about it because I been predicting they would do that, and they did, and I was excited that, oh cool, it actually happened. Yeah. And then they talked about all the different phones it was going to get supported on, and they had a list of like a dozen phones, only two of which have actually like launched like platforms,
which is theirs.
And the biggest one that was supposed, that had agreed to do it, was Samsung. And the big announcement at Google I/O this year was that Samsung actually will do it later this summer. And
I know,
which you're like, okay, like, you know, that's better than nothing. But
I just, for as much as we probably will make fun of Apple during their WWDC, like the big difference is everything will be available
before Christmas, like, and soon.
Yeah. Right. You can trust like what they're telling you they're coming out with.
Yeah. Every single API that they talk about at the developer conference will be available in September with the launch of the new operating system and a new piece of hardware to support it. Like
Impressive? Is it seem as forward and futuristic and sci-fi? Yeah. No. But
yeah,
you can depend on it.
And if they announce any hardware, it will be coming out in the next week. Like they're really good about that, and that's something that, yeah, I mean, again,
like Daydream, right? We're gonna do a standalone VR headset eventually,
right? Or yeah, we're gonna,
once our partners do it,
right? And it's like, as much as I get on how exciting I think the Tango the Tango platform is and all the things that they're doing, there's one phone that has it, and it's kind of bad. They have a second phone that's coming.
That's why they're coming out with a second one later.
I know. They and the Zenfone AR, which they announced 6 months ago. Like, this thing has been announced forever, and they still don't have an actual like launch date for it or a price. They finally announced that they're teaming up with Verizon to sell it, which is disappointing to me. But I and might actually stop me from buying one. But I because if I were gonna, because that's kind of where I was at. I was like, you know, if I was gonna go Android, it'd either be a Pixel phone or the Zenfone AR. That's kind of where I'm at. But I really just like Verizon. So I don't know. We'll see. But I mean, yeah, just looking at this, there's anyways.
So I just, for me, at least it's mixed emotions. Yes. Because on one hand, you're like, wow, this is pretty awesome. You know, they set out a vision, which I think is what they did here. Where they said, we're no longer mobile first. We are now AI first.
Right.
And I think they hit that. But you also get the sense of like, they're still working on it.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And then I was going to finish my thought with the Tango stuff and where it's coming. I got distracted by myself. They're yeah, a lot. They are creating, they've announced this platform and it's coming eventually. When Apple announces their AR APIs, it's going to launch into the hands of tens of millions of iPhone 7s, and it will launch, then it will be fully supported on the iPhone 8.
It won't do as much.
Right.
But it'll be there.
Yeah, and it will be fully supported with an enormous customer base. And so what's really important here is that big developers now have an incentive to actually develop apps for it. And that's something that Google doesn't do. And so even though Google's footprint is at 2 billion Android devices, it doesn't throw around the same weight for developers as iOS does.
Maybe that's the other thing that I really struggle with, where it's like, again, and you can't help compare the two, and I think they are comparable. just like F8 and whatever other ones are. Microsoft's whatever they call their conference. Anyways, I'm sorry. like with Apple, they know who their audience is.
Yeah.
Right? Like they're not talking, they're talking to you and I, but they're not talking to you and I. They're talking to developers and they're saying, here's this new operating system and here are all the APIs. Here's the cool things it's going to be able to do, blah, blah, blah. Right. They're talking about Swift and Metal and then whatever.
Yeah.
And I feel like sometimes like they're talking about their Mac OS and you're like, all right, this is less for developers, but they realize they're selling it too. But anyways, you can tell they know who their core audience is. It's developers.
Yeah.
And they speak to them. I mean, they speak to them in such a way that I can understand. But they're talking to them. Whereas like for Google I.O., I find myself going like, who's your audience?
Yeah.
Like, okay, you got some slow-mo guys, which I fully appreciate. Fully appreciate. And you're talking about how YouTube can do power up chats, which is kind of cool, that people can buy, which I don't know how I feel about that, but whatever. I'm like, I guess that's a developer.
Well, I think there's...
But I just don't... Well, I feel like their audience is developers, but I don't feel like that's who they're presenting to.
It's not, and I think it's because of the history of I.O., where Google I.O., the keynote, like, Google I.O. is a developers conference. And that's why they make a big deal about that, the developer keynotes and all the different stuff that's going on all week long, because they're going to be talking more specifically to developers. But that the big keynote, the one that everybody gets invited to for the longest time, was almost exclusively the Google experiments, the things that are now kept under the hood of the Alphabet company and all of the separate companies that... You know, that was where they talked about Waymo. That's where they talked about Verily Life Sciences. That's where they talked about the project or the Google X stuff.
That's right. And, I guess that's true. It was a big show and tell.
Yeah, and it that's exactly what it was.
It really was a pump up.
Yeah.
All right, all right.
And now they don't have all those really cool demos that don't have anything to do with Google, but they still want it to be this cool future forward thing. And they're just finding themselves. And I guess that's why I come back to saying, like, I'm kind of...
Feels like they need to adapt.
Yeah, I'm kind of...
In my opinion.
I'm kind of on the Google band. Like, this is... We're starting out negative, which is... So what we do.
Not fair.
With Apple...
I told you. I meant for this to be my last statement.
With Apple... Yeah, exactly. With Apple, we start positive and then work negative. With Google, we start negative and work positive.
Yeah, I know. It's awesome. We'll get around to it.
But... I because the thing is,
dude, don't go worry. I mean, I downloaded Google Assistant the second they talked about
me
it.
Me too.
And I'm like, yep. And I tried it, and it was awesome. Like I was talking about photos. I had it downloaded. I just hadn't opened it and synced it in a while. Yeah. I'm like, I'm syncing this bad boy back up.
Yeah, the stuff that they announced that is like up and firing is amazing. So let's get into it because they for one thing, like you said, they're an AI first company now. That's what Sundar. Oh, I'm gonna mess up his last name. I'm not even gonna go.
Pinch me.
That's not his name. See, my goal is to not be disrespectful by not even trying and failing. The CEO
Sundar Pichai.
Pichai. So the CEO of Google. That was his strategy, and that seems pretty obvious that that's what they're doing about, but they're really hitting it hard with their TensorFlow. TensorFlow is their suite of machine learning technologies. That's the umbrella name for it all. So like they've got their TPUs, their Tensor Processing Unit, which is their custom silicon chips that they use for doing all of their running all of their artificial intelligence. One of the big things about this is that, you know, we've talked about this before, what hardware acceleration is with a CPU, a general processing unit. The whole idea is that it can do any sort of process, and any sort of computation. But some computations take more time, like things that are highly linear, like doing matrix, multiplication can be very difficult for a CPU because it's not really it can do anything, it just can't necessarily do it efficiently.
Yeah.
Whereas a GPU, what they do is they take particular algorithms and they boil them down to their logic core. to the core logic gates, and then they literally burn it into silicon so that it is the things that it does are these very specific tasks, and they do it in hardware, which means that instead of taking 1,000 steps to do one computation, it now does that in one step. So that's what hardware acceleration is. It's
a little faster.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so the TPUs, the tensor processing units, that's what they're doing, but with artificial intelligence. And the first generation of them, they were all built around this idea of we've got these technologies, these different codes that you can write and use to train your AI, but running it is very straightforward, but it's computationally expensive to do on a CPU. So we'll design a TPU that you can train your neural network.
Optimized to do that math.
Exactly. You can take your neural network and then just load it into one of these units and it would just do it for you at high power.
That's cool.
So what you can then do is it allows you to do things like translate very, very quickly or do object recognition in your, you take a picture and it looks for objects in it very, very quickly. And that is what those things were used for. And that's why they got giant racks of them in all over Google. But turns out that a neural network will spend most of its time, a production level neural network, something that actually is used by people, will spend most of its time doing those sorts of tasks, being used, obviously. But the training portion of it can be insanely long. Like it can be doing, like identifying one picture on a trained neural network on a CPU is a million times faster than actually training the neural network to do that.
Yeah.
And so what they wanted to do was to basically, like, we want to accelerate that second part. And that's where there's
training.
The training part. And that's where they've gotten a ton of gains with this second generation TPU that they've launched. To that end, the company developed a way to rig 64 TPUs together into what they call a TPU pods, effectively turning a Google server rack into a supercomputer with 11.5 petaflops of computational power. Even on their own, the second gen TPUs are capable of delivering a staggering 180 teraflops of computing power and are built for just the kind of number crunching that drives machine learning today. It's pretty amazing that they're getting like giant cuts in computational time, like 1,000x. It's pretty amazing. Wow. How much faster they're doing some of their stuff. And everything that they do in AI right now is based on this. So it's like, their DeepMind stuff that they were doing, the AlphaGo that was playing the game Go, is based on this. Pretty much everything. And the cool part about Google is that they're open sourcing most of this. And so they're trying to give it to developers so that other developers can use it and have a reason go on to, you know, sign up for Google Cloud services and use Google's AI and stuff.
So it's an Amazon play, not necessarily.
Yeah. So that's one of the big things, is that they're trying to turn it into a platform. It'll be interesting to see Microsoft's response to this, because where Google has been building these custom silicon chips to do this sort of hardware acceleration, Microsoft, as we talked about a lot before, is building FPGAs, which allow them to effectively do the same thing, but they can do it on the fly with their hardware, and they can just design it when they want it, when they need it. And it'll be interesting to see if at some point, since it's all open source, if Microsoft just goes, oh yeah, and by the way, all of your TensorFlow AI stuff, yeah, you can run those on our cloud as well.
They'd be super smart to do that.
Yes, they would be. And you're not even emulating it with a FPGA, but you're recreating it in a soft way. It's pretty huge. And
I guess it depends on the speed differences.
Yeah. That's the biggest thing, is that there's a lot more, it's very expensive to do it the way that Microsoft's doing it, but it's very flexible. And speed wise, it probably is a bit slower, but they can just throw more processors at it. And there's a trade-off there. And, but it's one of those things where it gives Microsoft the flexibility to keep up, which is important.
That's a big deal.
Because TensorFlow is growing, and it's growing quickly, and Google is going out of its way to have it grow, have it be well-developed, have it be accessible to developers, and they want it to be the future of their platform. The other thing that they announced was TensorFlow Lite, which is the APIs for, TensorFlow is designed to be, you train the algorithm on a server, you run the algorithm on a server, you give it an endpoint on the server and say, you know, go to this server and then give it whatever information you want to process, and then the AI will give you the answer back. But that obviously has the disadvantage of, if you want to protect that information for any reason, the AI is communicating with a server. And Apple has gone out of their way to not do that. And it's having quite a bit of commercial success being able to say, we don't take your information. It all lives on the phone. So Google is trying to figure out how to compete with that. And that's what TensorFlow Lite is all about. And it is a framework that allows you to, once you've trained an AI, to now run it on mobile hardware, on phones.
I missed that subtlety.
Yeah, it probably indicates the fact that pretty soon here Google's going to start trying to push for FPGAs on phones, if not actual TPUs on phones. which is what Apple has an FPGA on their phone for this specific reason. And I'm sure everybody is gonna try to get in on that bandwagon because it's pretty awesome if you can do that. Because it allows for these, it allows for things that are otherwise very power. The other nice part about hardware acceleration of this stuff is that for power management, it's a lot easier. It's not nearly as expensive for the four. Yeah. So yeah, there's some huge gains here that are going on, and those two technologies sort of are going to be building the foundation for moving forward for Google and artificial intelligence.
Man, it's exciting.
Yeah, I like it.
So they had some examples, I guess, of how that works.
Yeah.
I don't know what your order is.
No, go for it.
and so one of them was, which again, future is Google Lens.
Yeah.
Is one of them. And so it's the idea of what they talked about was there are multiple ways to interact with your computer. And otherwise known as the phone in your pocket. And they're like, you know, there used to be a keyboard and a mouse. And then we got touch. And now we're starting to see voice and the camera, actually.
Yeah.
The way that you that your computer gets input from you. And so Google Lens is one of those things that's going to ship with Google. It will be embedded inside of Google Assistant and then eventually Photos. And the whole thing, which you know, we've been talking about with our photos, is it will help you identify things. So the Google Assistant one actually sounds crazy awesome, where you open it up on your phone, and maybe like they did one example of like, what's this? You show it a flower, and it will tell you what kind of flower it is because it will just recognize it from its you know knowledge graph based on photos that it's a type of flower. Or if you say like you're at a, I don't know, you're walking the street and you see a bunch of different restaurants of some sort and you're trying to figure out which one I want to go to. Instead of pulling up Yelp, you'd pull up the Google Assistant, show the, you know, just hover over it and it would recognize where you're at, you know, where you're looking. And then through photos and, you know, using street views data would recognize what the venue is. And then pop up a little information and tell you, here's the name of it. Maybe here's how many stars. Here's what they serve, price. Here's what some other people have done, you know, some reviews and stuff. And then you literally can just, you know, scan the area. Another one they showed, which, yeah, we'll see how this one works, is if you use the Google Assistant to look up, say, like your friend's Wi-Fi wireless router networking information, you again can just use the Lens on the Google Assistant to you know just grab the information and it will be able to interpret it and then
it's
connect you.
Is that sort of thing which is not available on the iPhone? That's a real want.
Well, I don't think it's available on Pixel phones yet either.
Yeah, but it's never going to be available on the iPhone.
I don't know about that.
Yeah, you do know about that. That's a system level preference thing that you can't. It's a system level thing that you'd have to that Apple doesn't give access to or the APIs to do that.
Hey, honestly, I'm kind of okay with that. I'm a little okay with that.
Why?
But this was one where I looked at it and was like, yeah, we'll see if that actually happens.
Honestly,
it's like
that is one of those
specific type. Yeah. Maybe
that is one of those things that drives me crazy though, because I don't know. I want a Wi-Fi keeper thing. I can't use the Wi-Fi at work for my phone because A, it's really slow. B, it's so slow that when I use my phone on it, it drags down the network. And C, when I use my unlimited LTE, it's not tracked by my company, which is maybe the most salient of the points. But I'd like something that just is location aware. And when I get to work, it turns off my Wi-Fi. When I leave work, turns it back on. Geofence like that. That'd be a great app. You can't do that because they don't have access to those APIs, which drives me crazy. But it's okay.
Some other things that you can do with Lens and the Assistant is instantly translate signs.
Yes.
Kind of what we were talking about, Japanese to
which
English.
Which is something that you've always been able to do, not always, but you've been able to do for a long time in the Google Translate app, but now they're bringing those services together and they're kind of showing off.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. They also were like, you can take a picture or look at, it's like taking a picture, you're showing it with your phone. Of say like a concert venue, and it'll pull up tickets, calendar events, maybe even streaming music and more for you to choose what you want to do with it. Yeah, that's the interesting thing. You're not taking pictures. It's what they want Google Glass to be, but it's on your phone for right now. And to me, I'm like, dude, get that in an AR version. Oh my word.
Yeah.
You will sell a bajillion of those.
Yeah, it'd be awesome.
And you could tell they're headed there, but they're taking it one step at a time. I totally appreciate that. So that was a really cool thing that they did. The Lens, it's also going to be available in photos, which I feel like they're already kind of doing it, where I actually find it super helpful. Their search is so much better than Apple's. Like, I've had time, so here's how I roll. So I've got both photo libraries. And I use Apple's because, you know, it's the default. It's there. It works really well and for 99% of what you're doing. Until you want to go find an old photo, then good luck.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, I'm going to scroll forever. Or what I do is I hop over to Google Photos. I search for what I'm trying to remember what's in it and what it was. And dude, it just finds it. And then usually what happens, and yeah, this is so bad, is I'll go, okay, when did I take this picture? And I can look that up or get the exact name of the photo and then go back to Apple Photos and search for it and actually download the original copy and share it like I was going to. How bad is that? That's horrible.
It's pretty bad.
But just need to combine the two. But anyways, super cool kind of, super cool things that they're doing with the Assistant, which, as we mentioned, it's out on iPhone. So if you have one, download it. It's super fun. Here, give me a question. I'll ask it. Let's see here. Assistant, what are you? I tried one. Here, this was actually kind of confusing. So I did one where I was like, where is the closest Papa Murphy's? It goes, I found a few places. I tapped on it. And then... it gave me some more just specific information about that one. And then I said this, I was like, open their website. Cause it sounded like it should do that. And it was like, open your website. And it took me to bankofamerica.com. I don't understand that. And it wasn't like, I mean, it hurt my question just right.
Right.
It wasn't like it misinterpreted me. That was kind of a weird one. I was like, huh, I wonder how they got the Bank of America from Papa Murphy's. But, which eventually I was like, they had another option to just do search results and they had the correct website there. So who knows, but, so maybe a couple bugs to work out still. But super cool. I think can you play games with it? Let's play a game. I could play audio games or chat games. Never mind.
Okay. How about one of
these? Oh, geez. Never mind.
Okay, got it.
But just kind of fun. It's things like that where you're like, man, that's so cool. And it makes me think too, like, did I get the right, should I got a Google Home instead of an Echo?
Yeah, I gotcha. That one... I
think I made the right short-term decision. Not sure if I made the right long-term decision.
Yeah, it's that one's tough for me because we can jump over to the next stuff with, I mean, because kind of closely tethered to this is Google Assistant. And one of the big announcements here is that they're now working with these actions and
actions on Google.
Yeah, and so obviously you just kind of covered like. The idea that the Google Assistant is now everywhere, right? It's on the iPhone, it's on your it's on Android, and it's on the Google Home. But the focus of a lot of the actions was around competing with the uh, competing with Echo Skills. And and now they're sitting there go, but the assistance is everywhere. So like the skills follow Alexa, so will Google's actions. But, and I thought this was a really cool idea. They were talking about the idea that it's everywhere. So it means that things are going to be different. Like if you've got an action for, you know, I want to order a pizza. And if you do that on your phone, that requires, that's going to have different options for the interface than it does for Google Home. Number one, you can type at it, which is a big deal, and in my opinion. Yep. So you don't have to be talking out loud. But then it can actually present to you interfaces like buttons and sliders and whatever, things you can tap. Whereas a Google Home can't, obviously. And so they are trying to figure out how to deal with that. And one of the things that they're talking about is that what you'll target is capabilities as you're developing these different actions. So let's say you are Domino's, and you want to make a pizza by an app. What you can say is there are certain capabilities that I want this action to work on anything that is talking only. I want this action to work on anything that is typing only. I want this to work on actions. I want this to work on anything that has a screen, has a screen for interactions. It has a screen for display. And so you can start to build actions where it's like, let's say you want your HBO and you can be like, okay, Google, play the latest John Oliver episode. And if you say that on your phone, it will start playing it on your phone. But if you say that to Google Home, it'll cast it to your TV. And
so does your TV have to just be on all times? That works.
So there's a thing called HDMI switching, which is it basically is like the HDMI on a monitor, where a monitor goes to sleep if it's inactive, and then you turn when you move your mouse, the screen kicks on. That's the sort of thing that you're supposed to have on your TV, where it will turn off, and then when your cast activates, the TV will automatically turn on. And then when it goes, it'll wake up, essentially. And then when you...
Picture with an Apple TV as well?
Yeah. Apple TV will do that.
For
but
any
it's,
HDMI
no.
connected thing?
See, that's the thing, is your TV has to have HDMI switching.
Yeah. If your TV has HDMI switching, any HDMI device, that would happen.
Well, that is basically true, because the protocol has been around for a really long time. And since most of these devices are built by computer companies that deal with monitors that deal with that, like for some reason, and I do not understand this at all monitors have this technology. So anything that plugs into a monitor basically it already works. But anything that doesn't have anything that's a TV, for whatever reason, they don't do it this way. I don't get it. So most devices have it built in. Out your Apple TV, if you have automatic HDMI switching on your TV, you turn on your Apple TV and the TV kicks on. Your Apple TV goes to sleep and your TV kicks off.
Interesting. Like a monitor.
Yeah. And
I didn't know that.
Yeah, so that's what it's supposed to be like. I don't know why Philips and Sony and everybody don't. Well, it's funny. Sony, one of the struggles that they run into is most, unlike
use their remote.
That's part of it. And monitors tend to have one HDMI or plug in it, whereas TVs tend to have multiple. And so it's become very common where the latest Samsung TVs are getting, one of the biggest complaints is, how do I turn that off? Because you'll be watching a TV show and your Chromecast will decide to update and it'll switch it to the Chromecast update screen, even though you're in the middle of a TV show, which people really hate. So they're still trying to figure it out, how to do it exactly and make it work. But they're working on it. And the goal is to get to that point. But I really like this idea where it's like, you know, Amazon is the Wild West of skills and AI and speaking devices.
Oh my gosh. So Wild West.
Which is,
I downloaded this one skill. It's just called Meow.
Yeah.
It's pretty funny. You just go, Alexa, meow meow, or talk to meow meow or something like that. And then it's this app that you talk to it and it meows back at you. Eleanor loves it.
Oh yeah.
Not surprisingly. It's really weird, but I think they featured it on like what's new on Alexa this week, and I was like, huh, that's fascinating. It's just goofy, but I think also speaks to the Wild West nature of it all.
Yeah, exactly. And so but as a result, it's sort of like they've now got they've got Alexa in apps. They've got Alexa on cars. They've got Alexa on the Echo. They've got Alexa on
same strategy.
But their problem is that like their skills don't necessarily have those sort of like when you develop a skill, you're like, I want to develop this skill for the Alexa Echo. I want to develop this skill for the Alexa Echo show. And so there's not as much. Whereas Google seems to be trying to build for developers an ecosystem that's very forward compatible, that you design it, and if somebody comes out with a new, if you design something with touch interactions and Google develops a Google Home with touch interactions, you don't have to do anything. It'll just work. and which I think a lot of people, I think that long term, that's going to pay dividends for Google. And their strategy. Oh. I like it. It's neat. It's very neat. Yeah. I like it. And that's the other thing that they were kind of pointing towards is this idea that the Google Echo Show is a cool device that Amazon came out with because it's basically a monitor on your Echo. And Google doesn't really need that because they kind of already have screens everywhere in that your Cast is hooked up to your TV. So if you want to have visual feedback, you just tell it to cast stuff. And so Google is unlikely to come out with a Google Home anytime soon that has a screen on it because it doesn't make sense to them in how they operate. But the other big thing, and this is kind of exciting, I like this article, and this has to do with Google Home, is Google managed to, this is my title for this article, Google managed to add phone calling to Google Home without creating another messaging platform.
That's awesome.
Yeah. now your Google Home speakers can make phone calls, and without doing anything, it's now natively supported in America and Canada. You just say, hey, Google, call this person or this number, and it will do that. It'll use just a fake number. You can hook it up to your phone so that it will show your phone number when you call somebody if you want. The biggest problem with it, they say, or the biggest limitation to it right now is that unlike the Echo, where you can call Echo to Echo, on Google Home, if you call from your Google Home, when somebody calls you back, it'll go to your phone. And you can set it up, I guess, where I think it's possible so that you can actually pick up phone calls with your Google Home. But it's not as straightforward as what Echo's doing yet. But it's Google. They're iterative. They're working out as they go forward. One of the cooler things that they can do is because they can identify different users already with theirs, is you can set up if Home is set up to support multiple users, each can pair their own phone number, and the Home will recognize who's trying to make a call. So
it's pretty cool.
Yeah. So if you and your wife have different phone numbers, you can or your roommates or whatever, you can.
Doesn't.
I know. You can make a phone call, and it'll be your phone number that will show up at the end point. And so when they call you back, it'll go to your phone and not to a general, which I think is great. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, I thought that was pretty interesting. I totally agree. So do you have Google Photos?
Yes, but I'm like you.
Okay.
I haven't opened it in a really long time.
Yeah.
You know what I'm going to do, James? I'm gonna wait 1 week to open it.
Oh, okay. Why a week?
Because I will have gigabit Ethernet, and I want to see how fast it goes when I update my entire library after nearly a year. Pretty excited to see what happens. I'm thinking I need to hardwire my Mac too. I think I need to get an Ethernet cable. Just plug it in.
Really?
Yeah.
Why?
Because I want every gigabit it can offer to my computer. Wi-Fi is a little bit limited, frankly. For multiple streams, it'll be good, but you can't get gigabit speeds over Wi-Fi right now. Not with my Mac Mini, but I've got a gigabit Ethernet card in my computer, which means that if I can, it'd be awesome. I'm just saying. I'm getting into it, James.
I understand.
Go old school, because I want fast connections.
I used to have my computer plugged in. Don't anymore. Maybe I should.
Yeah. I don't know. Who knows?
Reduce some of my issues.
Yeah. So,
anyways, photos, they're cool. Their whole like shared library thing. So I was watching it the keynote with Jesse, and okay, not the entire thing, but just part of it. And she happened to see the photos part, and they were talking about the shared libraries, and I would automatically, it'll send, I don't know. If you set up a filter to say any photos I take of the kids or my wife, like automatically share with her, she was like, never do that. I'm like, oh, okay. She was like, that sounds horrible. I'm like, yeah, but then you'd see stuff. She's like, no. I'm like, okay. I guess I won't. But it was interesting. I like the problem they're trying to solve, which is share it with people automatically. And then there are photo books. I wonder who's doing the printing on those. Whew, man, I hope it's HP. We should be upset if it's not.
Probably should be upset.
Yeah. But I thought it was neat. Like the idea behind the photo books was you just select a whole bunch of different ones and it'll find the 40 best and compile them for you and put them together.
That's cool.
Like, that's pretty cool. Again, it's that idea of like taking a lot of that work out of it that you used to have, which gets back to that whole travel agent idea.
Yeah.
Like, oh, you want to build one of these? Super easy.
And then
I'm thinking like that'd be fun for I don't know, when my kids turn a certain age or for graduation or something. That'd be cool to just like, of course, I don't know, there's a part of me that's like, yeah, I made this in 15 minutes.
Yeah.
Or just after a trip, that'd be neat to.
I think that's the one where it's like, it'd be nice to have like, if you're going to show, because you like sharing pictures from trips and stuff and you want to talk about the memories and you want things to sort of jog your memory of a trip. But it's also really annoying to be like, oh yeah, and we took 73 pictures of this one thing trying to get the best one, but I didn't actually go through the pictures to get the best one. So I'm showing them all to you right now. I'm just quickly flipping through them. That. You actually go through them.
I'll have two albums. I'll have all of that trip. And then I have favorites.
Okay.
And the favorites are, it's here's what I've determined to be the best of the best.
The best of the best.
With honors.
Yeah.
That's a Men in Black reference, by the way.
I gotcha. I know.
I really like this idea too of lens works with, we mentioned it really quickly, like you could take a photo and then you can pull up the lens and it will tell you about the photo. If it's a building, they'll tell you, here's the building.
Right.
Because they'll know where you took the photo. They'll recognize it. I thought some of those things were pretty neat.
It is very neat. The other thing that they displayed was Intelligent Fill, which is kind of, they're stepping on Adobe's toes here. The example they showed was you're taking a picture of your daughter about to swing the bat, but you're taking a picture of it through a chain link fence, and they're showing it being automatically deleted and filled in, so it looks like there's no fence there. Which, once again, this is something that Adobe has been doing, but at extraordinary price when you download, when you get Photoshop for a while. And it's the sort of thing that Adobe is pushed. This is the area of AI research that Adobe is pushing hard, is how do you do things like Intelligent Fill, where an AI will just go through and do the touch-up and modifications to your photos automatically. And this goes back to our what we had been talking about over the last couple of months about the idea of a pure software camera. You know, at what point is this not actually a picture of what you took a picture of? And
yeah,
they're going to start pushing those limits, I think. And I think you're going to start to see more and more of these types of tools, things that where Facebook is going to be challenging Instagram for what Instagram does with their virtual cameras. You're going to start watching Google start to go toe to toe with Adobe and challenging them for their AI features and their digital camera type stuff. And how do you make a better picture quickly through artificial intelligence? And
yeah,
I think, you know, it'll be really interesting to see. Google thinks it's really, really important, but it's not really their core competency. It leverages one of their core competencies, but it's not one of theirs. So it'll be really interesting to see how successful they are here. is it good enough to just be really great with AI, or do you have to have a deep understanding of photo editing as well? Because Adobe's going to make the argument that if you don't understand photo editing, you're stuck. And whereas obviously Google is going to come and say, nah, if you got AI, this sort of stuff is easy. And I think you're going to see more and more of these types of really intelligent features. Not because at this point, one of the big deals with their camera app for the Pixel is all of the cool automatic image correcting that it can do.
Right.
And now they're going to start taking those features to more and more extraordinary steps of, you know. And one of the things that I'm always really amazed by is, I don't know if on Reddit they've got the r Photoshop battles subreddit. And yeah, the thing that always blows my mind is when they'll do inevitably, no matter what it is, like whatever the object is that you're supposed to be Photoshopping around, somebody who's being clever will just delete it from the picture and be like, there, I fixed it. And so if it's like, so one of the most recent ones I saw, it's this girl sitting on the ledge of a boulder and like looking terrified. And so then one of the submissions is the picture of the boulder with the girl deleted, and they used somehow they filled in the background behind her and it looks amazing. But the response to that one that blows my mind good, that's blow my mind good, is somebody responded by deleting the boulder and leaving the girl. The boulder is a quarter of the picture. Like, most of the landscape is covered by the boulder, and it looks flawless. And that's a lot of skill and really, really powerful tools in Photoshop and to be able to do that. And those are the sorts of features that Google's going to start bringing to their pictures now.
Gonna put photo editors out of a job.
I know.
Man, we're just going after everybody tonight.
Oh, software eats the world, man. We're not even done yet. yeah. The other kind of big news that they're talking about with
YouTube.
YouTube. I was gonna jump to Android Go.
Yeah.
So they also
I was kidding about YouTube.
You what?
I was kidding about YouTube.
Oh, okay. They Android Go they announced is a parallel version of Android that is designed to work on phones with as little as 528 megabytes of RAM, but they're really targeting the 1 gigabyte of RAM and less market, and there's
super smart.
Yeah, there's basically no Android phones that run at that right now. But what they're basically arguing is that if you were to use a much older chipset, which are now incredibly cheap to buy, you can build, you know, sub $300 phones, sub $200 phones, sub $100 phones, sub $50 phones that can at those specs. And they're trying to figure out what operating system to run on. And Google said, you know, we've built an operating system that targets those. It uses it. It keeps a lot of the core functionality. They're working on it. Yeah, they're going to keep a lot of the core functionality of Android. The things that make it work. It'll be intelligent about the resources that it can use and what sort of apps it can run. But this is how they're going to target their next 1 billion users. They're at 2. They want 3, and they think
I don't blame them.
The next 1 billion is that this very at the super low end of hardware. And part of targeting the next 1 billion is introducing new languages. So Android, the only officially supported language for, well, it's not true, but the only language that anybody cares about for Android that's supported has been Java. And, and they originally, when they did the first Android phones, it was basically a very thin version of Linux that ran a Java virtual machine, basically. And but they've over the years they've built the operating system to directly compile Java into machine code that runs on Android, which allows them to now support other languages really without having other to expand the VM, the virtual machine, too much. So now Kotlin is their new programming language,
which everyone seemed pretty excited about.
Yeah, it's a big deal. I'm willing to look into it. I really like Java, but I'm always interested in new languages too. It's now a first class language. Super new programming language built by JetBrains, which also coincidentally developed the JetBrains IDE that Android Studio is based on. Like Java, which is the default language for Android development, Kotlin is a language that runs on the JVM, and it's already possible to use Kotlin and many other JVM languages for Android development. Android doesn't use the JVM exactly, but yeah, it's so we've already kind of covered that. Kotlin will be included in Android Studio 3.0 by default. Google is pledging their support to the language going forward. The language has a lot of similarities to Java in structure. It's object-oriented, it's statically typed, designed for similar problems Java solves. But because it's a clean slate, in many ways, Kotlin adds a lot of nice-to-have features, much cleaner syntax, ideas from functional programming, and other enhancements over Java. So it's basically...
That sounds great.
It's Google Swift. This is everything we've done, but we're just starting with a new language. You can still develop for Java. You can still use other languages that will compile to the JVM, the Java virtual machine. But this is the one we want to really emphasize because we're cleaning it up and we got a lot more flexibility with it. It was pretty funny because they had a demo of writing in Kotlin. One of the big advantages of it that they're going for is trying to they want it to be a language where you develop once, write once, run anywhere, or more specifically, write once, run on iOS or Android. And they've created an IDE that can compile to Android and will automatically select material design preferences, and it will compile to iOS and automatically select the design language of iOS. Huh. So things like the upper bar where you get your phone information, instead of overwriting that, it'll hold on to the iOS preferences on that. And it's a really big deal because Apple can reject your app based on those sorts of things. And Google won't promote your app if you don't stick with material design. What was really great about it, and actually I appreciated this, they wanted to show during the developer conference, they wanted to show the development of a really simple app that was it was write once, compile twice to both platforms.
Yeah.
And they wanted to show it interacting with Firebase, which is their cloud-based API engine that's really accessible and cool. they developed a really simple chat app. that you could make, you know, send chats on one side and it would automatically push it to everybody else that was connected, which was an iOS phone, an iPhone. And but it was just hilarious because it was very tongue in cheek. They were like, yes, we realize we're building it. We, Google, are building a chat app. It's just it's like 300. Yeah. And the enemy, which I think is really promising. And what's promising for the company, it's not a good sign for my prediction that Google will end the year with more chat apps than they started. Because they seem to understand at this point that they have way too many and they need to focus. And and they're at the point where they're mocking themselves about it, which is the first step to recovery, step one, I think. Yeah. And are you addicted to chat apps? So yeah, it's cool. It seems really cool. It's something I like new things. So I might check it out and just see what it's like. Get my feet wet. Yeah, it's cool stuff. And then, yeah. The other big area of development this week was VR, AR.
That's right.
I thought, and so we already talked about the fact that the Samsung's Galaxy phones will be getting Daydream support. As a caveat to the fact that it's been over a year since Samsung said their devices would get Daydream support, and they haven't yet. They also did have kind of a rough year with their flagship phone, so that might have something to do with their delays. But it is coming to Samsung, which is a huge deal because, you know, when we talked about, you know, how Apple when they finally launch support for AR stuff, it's going to go live on tens of millions of phones, which will give developers the confidence to develop because that means they know users are there. And when Samsung turns on Daydream, that'll be a big deal for developers because it means they know users are there. If you build an app, there are going to be people that own a phone that can use that app, and it beats the chicken and the egg problem. So this is a big deal for the platform. But in addition to being supported on phones, they also announced that Daydream is getting its own standalone platform. And which is kind of cool. It's basically it's a VR headset.
Is it? I haven't seen anything telling me otherwise.
Wait, what? You haven't seen
How do you know it's cool?
Because some people have used it and they said it was cool.
they use their standalone VR?
Yeah, they had the demo rig and some of the journalists got to use it. But they weren't allowed to take pictures of it because they're like, it's bulky and dumb. Oh my gosh, I totally forgot. Microsoft, freaking hate Microsoft. So they had a HoloLens at the Maker Fair yesterday that they were demoing that people could try and use. But you had to sign up for it. And I went up to them relatively early in the morning and was like, can I try the HoloLens? That would be awesome. And they're like, yeah, definitely. We have a time slot available at 11 a.m. tomorrow morning. I hate you people. Why would you say that? So I didn't get to try the HoloLens, but
bummer.
I know. But yeah, so the Daydream. So basically the idea here is so far everything Daydream has been, you know, designed for Android, for phones. Now they're talking about building a standalone headset that will allow you to do VR. And the biggest thing here is that it is going to use inside-out tracking, which is how Microsoft is going about their tracking. So they're going to use the technology from Tango, and they have some cool new name for tracking your location in buildings and stuff. I can't remember what it's called. It's like VTS or something like that.
VPS.
There we go.
Visual Positioning Service.
Yeah, which is basically what they're saying is they're taking all of the Tango API and hardware and boiling it down to one endpoint, which is the question of where am I? Where am I looking? And that will use two things to allow you to do that. One, it will use continual positional tracking, so you can do Six Degrees of Freedom without some sort of a tracker unit around you. But it will also, and this is, I think, where the bigger deal with VPS is that it means that they'll build up a catalog of buildings and stuff. So they already know where you are GPS-wise, but they'll be able to further locate, you know, narrow. If you're inside a building where GPS doesn't work very well, if you're on the third floor where GPS completely fails, they're hoping that to build out an API that will give you the information about what room you're staying in based on what you're looking at, which a human being can do with ease if they're familiar with the place. But computer can't do at all. And they're working on doing that. Anyways, point is they're going to use this VPS. What? Vaporware.
Yeah. Vaporware.
I completely agree that that's vaporware, but the VPS as a way to do positional tracking, I think is that's the bigger deal, is that it's like,
I agree.
Is that it's going to allow them to do what the HoloLens is doing, where you can walk into any room, you slap on these VR headsets, and all of a sudden you can interact with the room. And if there's objects in the room, they can overlay those things so that if there's a table, you don't run into it, which is not something that current VR stuff can do. So that's a big deal. And they had another technology that they demoed, which was kind of neat. And the more I read about it, the more I realize that it's actually, they pitched it as this like super revolutionary type of technology. And it's not really, but it's a cool implementation of it. Basically what they showed was they went to Industrial Light and Magic, who are the guys behind Star Wars. And they got they had them render a scene in basically a 360 scene of a Star Wars, when you're in like in the like hangar bay of the Death Star sort of situation.
Okay.
And so it's classic, you know, very familiar Star Wars setting in what it looks like. But Industrial Light and Magic rendered it so that it was super high resolution, maybe not cinema quality, but way better than video game quality. That's what we're looking at.
Okay.
And then what they did was they used that information to render a very low polygon version of that environment, where they were essentially took a bunch of pictures around of this virtual environment, and then compiled it into something that was 100 times fewer polygons. And it allowed them to do was it allowed them to render this scene on mobile hardware. And so everybody that used it, they were like, it looks fantastic. It actually feels like you're in in this world, because they basically created these super complicated texture maps and overlaid them onto very coarse polygons. And so they're talking about how that's probably going to be the future. Like for a little while, definitely maybe a couple of years, that's going to be a big thing that Google is going to be pushing, is this is how you get really high end. You want to experience this world, but you don't want to have to buy a high-end computer to do it. This is the solution. And where this has been used before, and I think the first time it was used where people got really excited about it was with Half-Life 2, which was built by Valve. The game looked amazing, and this was well over a decade ago that it came out. I mean, and it still holds up graphics wise, but one of the big things that they did and how what they changed is they literally would create these environments with really, really, really dense polygon maps, stuff that no computer could render. And then they created an algorithm that took all of these really dense polygon
maps,
calculated all the shadows, all the light, all the different shading in real time, and then turn those into texture maps. And they use an algorithm to figure out the best way to take these really complicated and high visual fidelity, high polygon counts, and turn them into low polygon texture maps. And what it allowed them to do was to make these amazing looking video game that ran really, really smoothly on low-end graphics cards. Which is effectively what Google is doing here, and it's something that studios with a lot of time and development prowess have been doing for a while. It's harder. It's a lot harder to do and then just adding more polygons and saying buy a better graphics card. But for mobile platforms like this, it's kind of your only option to even compete with a PlayStation, a PS4, you know, PSVR or HTC or Oculus. So it's cool. And Google being Google, they'll open source it and make it super easy for everybody to do and to deploy onto any platform. And all of a sudden, your Oculus will go from looking like just amazing to real. And, you know, it's cool. It's cool stuff. I'm excited to see what they're doing with it. So,
yeah, some pretty amazing research, I guess, is how I would characterize it.
Yes, I'd agree. It's cool. Cool, cool, cool. So we've got a couple other stories.
Anything else?
Not from Google I.O. Ready to sprint through a couple of extra ones?
Yeah.
So this first one is kind of a small story, but it's interesting. Desmos is a company. I love calculator apps. In my dock on my iPhone, I have, let's see here. I have my notes app. I have Safari. I have my music app. And then I have a folder with 10 calculators in it. I use a lot of different calculators. I like a lot of different calculators and I want them. I'm at fingertips at all time. And I have a new one that I've added to my collection this week, and it's called Desmos. It's a graphing calculator, but this is the big deal. It's a graphing calculator that you can now use on standardized tests in America.
Whoa.
Yeah, which is a giant shot at TI. Like, we're all aware of the TI-84. We've all spent hundreds of dollars on a computer on this thing that has been around forever, and they still make enormous profits, even though it costs them literally pennies to manufacture them. But they're allowed on standardized tests, so everybody uses them. Obviously, calculator apps have the unfortunate side effect of being on phones. Having the internet attached to them. Well, Desmos worked hard to sort of work around that, and basically, that's how they did it. The Desmos calculators will be embedded directly into assessments, meaning students will have access during the test with no need for an external device. It'll also be available to students in grades 6 through 8 and high school throughout the year. The calculator is free to use, and the company makes money by charging organizations to use it. So basically what happens is they built an app. They got it working, and then they built a web app that you can then embed in other stuff.
So you can
use it on your homework. You can get really good at it. You can understand how to use it, because that's one of the advantages of the TI-84 is that it's written into every textbook. You have it at home, you can use it, and you can practice with it. Well, now this is an app you can practice with, and then when you open up your assessment on a computer, it'll be directly embedded into it. So all the tools that you're familiar with,
cheating.
Yeah,
interesting.
And so it's begun the inevitable end of the TI-84. We're watching it happen. And speaking of,
about time.
Jeez, Louise. And then speaking of Amazon eating the world, speaking of software that eats the world, Amazon. This is a great article that I recommend you read. And if it weren't Google I.O., we would spend most of the show talking about it. It's written by Zach Cantor, who is co-founded a software startup in December. Each month, he sends out an update to investors to keep them updated on progress. The past month was a bit different. And it's our industry. Retail is going through transformation. And it talks about the retail bubble and the impending apocalypse of retail and what role Amazon plays in it and why Amazon is such a dominant player. And what's really cool about it is it gets into this idea of you talk about how there's vertical integration is really, really great for costs. But because you get one, you only have one buyer and one supplier, it tends to breed bureaucracy and inefficiency. And so you've watched like the car manufacturing industry go through cycles where they'll vertically integrate everything in the car manufacturing process, from manufacturing steel to selling cars. It'll all be owned by one company. And then they'll start to deinvest and they'll start to sell all these things because it gets really expensive. And they'll go, and then eventually it'll become cheaper to just buy a company than to do it internally. And they'll go through these cycles. And what he's basically said is that the biggest innovation that Jeff Bezos has actually added to retail is it's not the retail things they're doing. It's how they deal with vertical integration. And basically what he said is that there's nothing that they do in the company that they do internally that they won't turn into a platform without external APIs. And the argument that he makes is that when they do that, if you have an internal tool that you turn into a platform that other people can use, if they're not using it and they're using another system to do that, then all of a sudden you realize that there's an efficiency there and there's costs there that are inappropriate. And so you get all of the feedback loops of using an external provider and competition that drives down the price, but you get all the efficiencies of the tools are purpose-built for you, and you get those integrations and you get the advantages of the vertical integration. And if the platform turns out to be really advantageous, that's great. And he said that AWS is the perfect example of that. And but he brought up a couple of different examples and Prime Delivery and Shipped by Amazon. This idea that Amazon made the argument of they vertically integrated all of their warehouse stuff for all of their products. And they said, this is the best in the world. We think it's the best deal. And so let's prove that by turning it into a platform. And now they've got the Fulfilled by Amazon, where the individual, whoever you're buying it through on Amazon, you'll say it's made by Monoprice, Fulfilled by Amazon. Monoprice owns the inventory in the Amazon software. And once you buy it, Amazon will go through and deliver that. And they've gotten to the point where you can actually buy a product owned by a different company, stored in the Amazon warehouse, hosted on AWS, and bought through a different website. And Amazon delivers it because they sit there and go, as a platform on both ends, whether you're buying it through Amazon or buying it through somewhere else, it just having that feedback loop gives them the advantage of quickly identifying problems in their service, which prevents the bureaucracy creep. And they're doing this everywhere. And we don't have enough time to get really into it, but he goes through a bunch of different examples of how they do exactly that. They have these internal services that have huge advantages because they're vertically integrated. So they turn it into a platform, they open it up to the outside, and it gives them immediate and continuous feedback that keeps the prices low, keeps the competition high, and prevents it from getting bloated, which effectively allows them to be. And it's the reason why Walmart, who is probably the best positioned company on earth to compete with Amazon over the next decade, is going to really struggle. And it's because they've got an amazing distribution network, but they have no feedback. They don't have an external feedback other than bureaucracy and market research to try to figure out if they're actually, you know, how well they're doing and where their inefficiencies are. Whereas Amazon has market competition to kind of show them where they're deficient. And since they do that on everything, it leads to a company that is really, really efficient and really impressive. So cool. I like it.
Yeah, that is cool. Wow. Yeah, they're an impressive company for sure. All right. Two real quick ones. Just real quick updates because we've talked about them in the past, and so just going to follow up with them. Number one, the guy, the one Uber engineer, Anthony Lewandowski.
Yeah.
The judge says you're not allowed to work on self-driving tech anymore for Uber. So he's been put on hold. And there's some other stuff going on that does not look good for Uber, which it was interesting. Uber was like, oh, no, it's a win because we can keep working on it without him.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
Like, yeah, you know,
hey, man. Like, hey, silver lining.
Yep. Yep. And then the other one is the FCC has officially started rolling back net neutrality. Mm. They held the vote. Shucker, 2-1. They're going to start doing it, but it's not the end of the world. But
it's just the end of the internet.
Starting up the open commentary time. Or not. According to Ajit Pai, there's no need for the rules anyways because there was nothing broken to begin with. According to his constituents. Mm-hmm. Oh, man. The more I learn about that guy, well, the more you're like, I don't know about you.
We'll see what Pence does once. You know what? Yeah. And that was enough politics for the show.
I guess so. All right. Those were the quick updates. That was it. All right. So thanks for listening. And listening to episode, 295. We really do appreciate it. Don't forget, you can check out all the show notes on furloughbros.com. Again, episode 295. Just go do slash there. If you'd like the show notes sent directly to you, you can also do that. You can sign up right on that same page. And then finally, this podcast is supported by listeners like you. If you would also like to contribute, we have 4 different levels. You can check out furloughbros.com to see how you too can become a patron. All right. Let's see here. I am James Furlough. My alien-loving, don't-get-off-this-earth brother is Matthew Furlough. And so we will talk next time.